Hey everyone, and welcome back to your Linux and open source news show. I'm your host, Nick, and this is a podcast where we discuss everything that happened in the Linux, open source, privacy, and open web world. And this week, we have a bunch of cool stuff. First, FlatHub is going to separate from the GNOME Foundation and become its own entity. Second, Arch Linux got a €500,000 grant to develop their infrastructure a bit more, and that comes after Valve already contracted some work for them. Firefox is now dropping Do Not Track as a feature, which seems like a step back for privacy, but we also have the post-open model trying to bring some money to every open source developer and contributor. We have the Fedora project lead stepping down and a lot of other things. So as always, if you want to dive deeper into any of these topics, don't hesitate to check out the links in the description. If you want to support the channel, there are plenty of links in there. And speaking of supporting the channel, we have to thank our sponsor, Tuxedo Computers. If you follow the Linux channel, the YouTube channel, the Linux Experiment, if you didn't know, that's my main job. Tuxedo has been sponsoring that channel for about 3 years now. They make desktops and laptops that ship with Linux pre-installed, and all the hardware is specifically picked because it works really, really well with Linux. They even developed the various patches and drivers that are needed, if they are needed at all. They have a wide range of devices, and everything I do these days, whether it's on YouTube, on this show, or anything else that I do, is done on one of their devices. So if you need a new computer, you want to run Linux on it, and you want to support a company that actually supports Linux, well, check out Tuxedo Computers. The link is in the description of the episode. Okay, so FlatHub is going to be its own thing now. It used to be handled mostly by the GNOME Foundation, but they're now looking to spin FlatHub into its own entity, and they're actually trying to hire someone to help with the management of this, with the legal and financial stuff, and generally just to handle all this transition from being part of the GNOME Foundation, funded by some GNOME sponsors, to being its own entity with its own sources of funding. FlatHub would still retain most of its funding that comes from Endless, the Endless Foundation. They make Endless OS, a distro made for education and ease of use. KDE is apparently also involved in that process, likely to really cement the fact that FlatHub is not a Red Hat thing, because yes, some people seem to think that, or it's not a GNOME thing, or at least it really won't be anymore. It is an app store for Linux, no matter the desktop or the toolkit. The budget for the person being hired is apparently $12,000 for 4 months of part-time work, which seems fair if it's part-time, but 4 months to create an entirely new foundation or business and to draw contracts with Endless to sort the ownership of the code, of the repos and everything, that feels a bit short. This part-time work would also include overseeing the deployment of payment systems and donations to FlatHub, also managing bank accounts and creating all the governance documents, all the developer agreements, transferring stuff to and from the GNOME Foundation. That's a lot of work for a short amount of time. Anyway, no matter how long it takes, it is a good thing to spin FlatHub into its own entity and being its own thing. We already had some people kind of being annoyed at the guidelines on FlatHub to appear in the recommended apps, because these guidelines clearly were written by people used to making icons and to developing GNOME apps. Because if you were a KDE app, there was no chance you would ever get featured by this, because your icons just were not symbolic enough, or were too skeuomorphic, or just didn't work, or your metadata wasn't up to snuff, because that's how KDE does its metadata. It's a good thing to have FlatHub separated and being completely independent. More people will trust it, more developers will use it, and since it doesn't seem to have an impact on funding, it's pretty good. Now, Arch Linux is getting even more money. After we had Valve announcing that they were funding some infrastructure-related work for Arch, that presumably will help them build SteamOS faster and for more architectures, probably ARM-based devices with SteamOS, It's now the Sovereign Tech Agency, giving €500,000, €562,000 specifically. That's about $600,000. As always, with this German agency, they are not just giving away their money, they're funding specific work, and this time it is the ALPM for Arch Linux Package Management Project. The goal is to make creating packages, installing packages, validating and verifying them, and managing repos all more robust, and to provide alternatives to some features that are provided by Pacman, the actual Arch Package Manager. The work will also help creating a set of specifications for the packaging format and its metadata, so it's not such a wild west when it comes to user-contributed stuff on Arch, and it's a bit easier to understand for end users. Rust libraries are also on the menu, apparently, notably to better handle signatures and cryptographic keys that are used to sign packages and to verify who created what, and also to handle individual packages from their creation to their installation. Now, all that work will, of course, be done in the open in Arch Linux's GitLab, so anybody can contribute and help on this. That is a lot of help for Arch recently, and that's great. Arch is not my favorite distribution, but it is undeniably a fantastic base to build whatever other type of distro or OS you want. SteamOS is an image-based system based on Arch, but you also have plenty of fully updated, fully rolling release model distros, and you have Arch itself. They're all a good base. So the better their packages and their package management gets, the better it is for virtually everyone. Arch users, non-Arch users that might want to take a look at how it's done, or even distros and entities basing their work on Arch. So it's great to see that money. And honestly, I hope that the Sovereign Tech Foundation and agency, they're doing this to maybe try and build a complete ecosystem of projects that they support to maybe at some point build a country-wide distro or open source offering. That would be nice. Now, Firefox is making another controversial move, or at least controversial on the surface. This time, they're ending support for the Do Not Track feature. This thing was just a preference, a checkbox, that when you ticked it, would send websites a signal telling them, do not log the activities of this web browser, of this user, do not track them around the internet using cookies, analytics, and tracking scripts. Now, why would Firefox remove such a privacy feature? That's mostly because almost no website ever followed that preference. Since 2009, when it was created, this thing was on a site-per-site basis, and it was up to the website to decide whether they were going to follow that preference or not. Chances are, there would have been some outrage if the browser could have displayed a banner saying, this website ignored your preference to not be tracked. But this was never done, maybe it wasn't even possible with the Do Not Track spec, so users never knew if websites followed Do Not Track or not, meaning most websites simply didn't. Firefox even says that this feature can reduce your privacy because some users will enable it and they will assume they're not being tracked when in reality they really are, so they wouldn't have taken any additional measures to protect their privacy. As always, it's better to take matters in your own hands and using a solution that blocks tracking locally. It doesn't let the website decide on whether it wants to track you or not. And honestly, since Firefox is the only browser that will keep full support for Manifest V2 in their own extension store and in the browser, Firefox plus uBlock Origin, or any Firefox derivative plus uBlock Origin, is very likely the way to go if you want to be safe and private online. Now let's talk a little bit about the open web, because it looks like the TikTok ban is getting closer and closer in the US. A US court upheld the law that planned this TikTok ban if TikTok did not sell to a US company. They judged that apparently this law doesn't contravene the Constitution. This means that unless TikTok finds a buyer and is willing to sell to a US entity, US citizens will not be able to access TikTok starting January 2025. This would be put into effect by basically just forbidding app stores to host that application. You just would not be able to download it from any smartphone market. Although that doesn't fix the issue of all the apps already being installed on smartphones, because I'm pretty sure smartphone manufacturers are not able to automatically remove an application from your phone, but maybe I'm wrong and we'll see that. TikTok, of course, will appeal that ban. They said it was conceived under false information, and ByteDance, their parent company, said they would never sell the application to a US company. So I guess TikTok is probably done now, at least in the US. Now, as a reminder, the main argument that the law tries to make is that TikTok is a national security threat, with data potentially going back to China. That hasn't been proven yet, but it's very likely because, well, Chinese law forces all companies to provide user data to the Chinese government. There's also suspicions of China meddling in US elections by pushing specific content and propaganda. Again, hasn't been proven, but it's highly likely, just like every political party and every foreign government wants to try and convince the population of their neighboring countries or rival countries to elect someone that's favorable to them. Now, interestingly, Donald Trump does not want to ban TikTok anymore. He did a full 180 on this because he says that it will now strengthen Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, which haven't proven favorable to his views. So he did a complete U-turn on this, and now he wants to preserve TikTok. So maybe the ban won't happen anymore or will be overturned. In the end, I personally really dislike TikTok and the shorts form factor, but banning TikTok will not automatically delete all the brain rot that is on TikTok. It will just move it to another platform. And banning something just because you don't like it doesn't feel fair. I mean, if you want to talk about national security and trying to influence foreign countries, the US has been doing that with their own social networks all over the world for years. So yeah, it's kind of weird. Now, you might remember that I talked a while back about a specific Linux driver that was meant to emulate how Windows uses synchronization primitives. It was called the NT-Sync driver, and its goal was to bring better gaming performance than solutions we have in Wine or Proton, like F-Sync or E-Sync. This code appeared in the kernel 6.10 dev cycle, but it wasn't merged at that point, and since then it hasn't really moved, it just wasn't ready. Well, this codebase received a bunch of changes from CodeWeaver developers, the makers of Wine. And the first change since May happened, apparently just to rebase the codebase on the kernel 6.13, meaning this patch set is now still relevant. There are apparently some changes that have been suggested for this driver to be included in the kernel, but hopefully now that this codebase is testable on the latest kernel, we might see it happen for the next release. Now, why should we want these patches? Because the performance gains compared to basic Wine are enormous. Compared to F-Sync, for example, Cyberpunk went in their testing from an average of 115 FPS to 149 in certain test scenarios. It's definitely a nice shot in the arm for Linux gaming. Apparently, this new driver really helps with games that are GPU bound, so probably on devices that don't have that much horsepower or don't have that powerful a GPU, for example, a Steam Deck, and it also apparently really helps with frame pacing and stutters in games, which have been an issue with Proton and Wine. So it's really good to see that patch coming. Hopefully they will manage to merge it and we'll all benefit from it. But there was some kind of ask me anything type of thing that happened with Bruce Perens, the co-founder of the Open Source Initiative, where he answered questions from Slashdot users, notably about his post-open concept and ideas. The goal of post-open is to find solutions for individual open source developers to get paid for their work on open source. Basically, the idea is to have a dual model. Individuals, small companies, and medium companies would be able to access all the source code, all the usual free and open source rights, and basically not pay anything. But big multi-million dollar companies would have to pay to get the same rights. Sort of like what we've seen as a trend in recent years, but without necessarily moving to a non-open license or to a source available license only. So the idea would be, the software is open source, fully open source or free software for individuals and small companies with the exact same rights as we enjoy today on a free and open source project. But the richest companies are effectively leeching off of that work and gratuity, not paying or donating a thing to a lot of projects that they rely upon and that they actually package and sell. And so these rich companies would have to pay instead of letting that money go to intermediaries instead of going to the actual developers and contributors. Parents said that an arbitrary limit, like any company making $5 million in revenue per year, should have to pay. And those costs would increase as the company's revenue would increase as well, capped at 1% tops. And that money would fund the work and the actual support that everyone needs from those open source projects. What is interesting here is that all this money would be paid to every contributor to the project. They would look at how much someone contributes and they would divide up the money from the companies between all the contributors relative to how much they've done. Of course, there are plenty of things to solve here. Do you count lines of code? Do you count commits? Do you count admin work, bug triage? Do you count marketing efforts? It's not necessarily super simple to handle. Like Perrin said, it will never be 100% fair, but it will still be better than people getting $0 right now. Now, this also means that this money would have to be collected by a foundation, which means some overhead because you have to pay the people running it, the people counting the money, dividing it up and paying it. And parents address that by saying that they don't want to be the Mozilla or the Linux Foundation of open source licenses, where you would have very well-paid executives managing things done by unpaid volunteers. He says that this is not a good look and he doesn't want that to happen. All of this would work through a post-open license that would write all of this in legalese and legal terms. And of course, projects could use dual licensing with a regular FOSS license for individual users and small companies and the post-open one for big companies. I think as an idea and a concept, it's pretty interesting. I don't know if it's the solution to make sure that people who contribute don't get burnt out, that the richest companies don't grab all the value from these projects and never give it back down to the projects they rely upon and that they sell. I don't know if it's the right idea. It does place limits on what people can do, and that might be against the spirit of open source. But also, when open source and free software were invented and started to emerge, you didn't have these giant companies that could capture the entire value of a project without ever giving back to it. The world was a very different place, so maybe we need to evolve our definition and our look at open source and free software to avoid the Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Apple of the world just grabbing everything for themselves and not giving back to the projects that make them make money. Now, if you wanted to buy a Steam Deck OLED, but you were put off by the price, Valve now sells refurbished Steam Decks OLED in the US, in Canada, in the UK, and the EU. The 512 gigs model is now $439 or £389, and the 1TB is $520 or £460. They've all been tested thoroughly, apparently, to make sure that they feel like brand new devices, they're all factory reset, they will have the same performance as a new unit, but of course, as with all refurbished units, they could have little visual blemishes, little dings and bumps and scratches. If that's okay with you, chances are the savings are worth it. That's $110 on the 512 gigs and $130 on the 1TB. Basically, it gives you an OLED deck at the price of the LCD one. It's just a refurbished unit. I'm a big, big fan of refurbished devices. That's basically everything I buy when it's available and possible. And the only time I ever got a device that had a single little scratch was on my iPhone, where the plastic black ring around the lenses is a little bit scratched, but the lens itself is not. So it's really not a problem, and it always saved me a lot of money, so I always go with that if possible. Now, of course, you might not have any refurbished Steam Deck OLED inventory left since this news happened. Fedora's project lead Matthew Miller is leaving his position as the head of Fedora. It's been 10 years and he feels like he shouldn't do it for longer, as even though he loves the job, he thinks someone with new energy and fresh ideas should take the lead instead to make sure that all the new projects and the new directions of Fedora are well supported and are expanded upon. He will instead join Red Hat as part of the Community Linux Engineering Organization, so he will still work on Fedora-related things, but not in the same capacity. He also says he will be available for the new project lead to help if necessary, and he also confirmed, interestingly, that Red Hat is still all in with Fedora, and that even if from the outside it might look like Red Hat is scaling back their investment in Fedora, they're actually still supporting it, and I quote, "the support is stronger than ever." Now, there should be a job posting from Red Hat soon. I always thought this kind of position was an elected one amongst the community, but apparently it's Red Hat hiring someone to manage Fedora. I will admit this is sort of my dream job, but I will also admit that while focusing on my YouTube channel, I have not contributed to any project in terms of code, time, volunteer work. I just did not have the time, so I have zero legitimacy to maybe get myself into this job. So I'll leave that to someone who is actually involved in the Fedora community. Not that I ever had a chance of having that job anyway. But if you do, don't hesitate. You'll see a job posting soon. If that's something that interests you, it's probably a cool job. Linux Mint 22.1's beta is now out with the Cinnamon Desktop 6.4. As always with Cinnamon, the version number changes, but it's not necessarily a huge release. It's nothing comparable to what you would get in a new version of GNOME or of KDE. So this new version brings Nightlight support straight in the display settings of Cinnamon, and it now supports X11 and Wayland, not just X11. The default theme is also tweaked, but that's not really something that will affect Linux Mint users because Mint has its own theme. There are still some visual changes to a lot of pop-ups, of modal dialogues, more rounded corners here and there, colored buttons in dialogues, better handling of icons, but most changes happened on the default Cinnamon theme that will only affect distros that aren't Mint. The on-screen display elements also should look a lot better now on Mint. Notifications and animations were improved. You now have power profiles through the freedesktop.org standard using dbus. The experimental Wayland session got some improvements as well. Notably, it now supports authentication to access certain features that was not working in the previous version of Mint, meaning the Wayland session was really not usable. Now you can install packages, update software, you can do system snapshots, you can access certain system settings. So things should be much better on the Wayland side for Mint. You will also get a faster software manager here. You'll get an updated bulk rename tool that lets you remove accents from file names. And you're also getting better apt dependencies support, thanks to Mint's AptKit and Captain tools that are basically wrappers or replacements for a lot of old apt and Debian package-based tooling. I probably won't have time to look at Mint 22.1 before Christmas. It's probably going to release around this time, but I'll definitely take a look at it either in the week between Christmas and the New Year or after the New Year. Now, there's good news for Fedora and Cosmic fans, if there's any intersection between the two, because it looks like Cosmic could be an official Fedora spin for Fedora 42. The Rust-based desktop is obviously still in development. It only got its fourth alpha like last week or 2 weeks ago, and it will get a first beta technically in January 2025. So there's no guarantee they will release a final version before April 2025 when Fedora 42 will be released. That desktop is, of course, open source, so there's no reason not to provide it as a choice for one of the spins of Fedora, and so there's a proposal to do just that. And as with all Fedora proposals, the steering committee still needs to approve it. Chances are this will depend on how Cosmic is shaping up, how stable it is, and how easy and compatible it is to package and include in the official Fedora repos. There's already a packaging effort for Cosmic on Fedora through a copper repo, but an official spin will have more support and will require more testing. I think it's really good to see this desktop being proposed on more distros. I would hate to see it limited to being a Pop OS only thing. It's never going to be voluntarily limited to Pop OS because it's open source, but as we've seen with Elementary OS, their desktop isn't really popping up on other distros because packaging it seems pretty complicated and pretty annoying, so there are not many variants of distros shipping with Pantheon and their applications. I hope Cosmic doesn't fall into the same pit, because it really limits the reach of a desktop when only one distro really offers it. I also kinda doubt that the final stable version of Cosmic will be ready for end of February, beginning of March. After that, it's probably going to be a little too late to include it in an official Fedora spin. I hope they can manage it. I really love Cosmic, and I probably will move to it full-time when it releases, just to see how fully usable or livable it is as a desktop. And to conclude on today's episode, the KDE Gear compilation has a new release out. If you don't know what that is, it's the compilation of KDE applications, applications maintained by the KDE project or endorsed and supported by the KDE project. And there are a few cool things in there. Ocular, the PDF viewer, now supports more items and combo boxes in forms that you can fill inside of the app, and it now prints more accurately. It also lets you sign documents more easily. Mercuro, the contacts calendar app, now handles certificates for contacts, so you can authenticate communications from them or calendar invites. Kdenlive, the video editor, now lets you resize multiple items on the timeline at the same time. Kwave, a video editor similar to Audacity but made for KDE, now works natively with Plasma 6. It was ported to Qt 6, and the interface was improved in the process with better icons. Dolphin gained better support for screen readers and also improved keyboard navigation, so you can navigate to the path bar, edit it, go back to the main view more easily. It's going to be a boon for accessibility. Sorting also has been improved in Dolphin. Files are now sorted in a more logical, human way, and videos can be sorted by duration now. And Dolphin also works better on mobile phones, but I don't think many KDE users will care about this. KCron, the graphical utility to plan cron jobs, got a new look. KDE Connect now works with Bluetooth only, and there are some visual improvements as well on how the device you connected to and the device you could connect to are presented inside the app. Tokodon, the Mastodon client, now works better on phones, and it shows a list of servers to make registering on a Mastodon server a lot easier. It also now supports PixelFed and a few other Fediverse service, and you get a following feed to see everyone that you follow. You can also quote posts, and you can view media as a grid. It's a really nice application for Mastodon users. NeoChat, the Matrix client, also now lets you block images and videos by default, so you can be safe from potentially harmful content when you join new rooms, and you get a nicer emoji picker, more sorting option for rooms, and better looking polls inside of those rooms. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are tons of changes to virtually every KDE app that you might have installed or like. Those changes will come to your distro when your distro decides to package those new versions. Or, as always, you can head to FlatHub or the Snap Store to get those versions a bit sooner. At the time I'm recording this, not everything is up to date, but it will come pretty soon. And so this will be it for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. As always, you can check out any of the links that I use to make this show in the show notes, and you can support me by checking out the links in the show notes and get some cool advantages as well. And there's also a link to our sponsor's website, Tuxedo Computers. In the meantime, thank you all for listening, and I guess you will hear me in the next one next week. Bye!